Okay, guys, okay. First of all, hello, it's nice to meet everyone. A little bit odd to meet you, those that I know already, but it's nice to see everyone. And kol hakavod for keeping the rules and being healthy and giving yourselves a chance to be healthy. Obviously, HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes those decisions, but we have to perform our hishtadlus. So every rule you keep is a good chance for each of us to try to remind ourselves, keep as many of the rules as you can. Baruch Hashem, the situation is improving in Eretz Yisrael. But the margin for error is razor thin, so you have to be really careful, okay? So let's just keep the rules and keep this thing going and keep ourselves healthy and keep learning. Can everyone hear me? I see a little bit. Okay, can everyone hear me now? Okay, what I'd like to discuss with you on a weekly basis is to give you a little bit of a sense of the founding Rashi Yeshivos of this family of ours. We're one big family. Certainly Yeshivat Har Etzion and Migdal Oz. We certainly share the same DNA. There are some differences between the two programs, obviously. Many, many significant differences, but the core DNA is the same. The teachers are similar. We all know each other. We all share food, shkuftas, what you eat, we eat. So it's all the same. Your workers are our workers. And I want to give you a sense of how this whole world of Torah came into being and why it's been so powerful and so influential. And in particular, the thought and the mind space of the founding Rashi Yeshiva, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zichrona Livracha, and Rav Amital, Zichrona Livracha, Rav Lichtenstein, give you a sense of some of their ideas. So I'm going to normally rotate. One week I'll discuss a little bit about Rav Lichtenstein. One week I'll discuss a little bit about Rav Amital. They're not going to be stories. They'll be shiurim with Makaros. But I'll freelance and I'll share stories with you and anecdotes and jokes, not necessarily jokes, about the things that I experienced personally to give you a flavor of who these people were. And I reserve the right every once in a while to give my own share, something that I feel is very relevant, Purim time, Hanukkah time, things, or if something crops up. Okay, so that's going to be Mirat Hashem, our weekly share. I think Racheli just told me this is actually going to be live, so I get to be live. So Mirat Hashem, we'll meet out here as long as the weather allows, and then we'll find other arrangements. So today I'd like to discuss first Rav Amital and how Rav Amital influenced modern religious Zionist thought. I'm assuming if you're sitting here in Alon Shvot, in Migdal Oz, in the West Bank, you're Zionists. I'm assuming Baruch Hashem you're religious. So we're all religious Zionists. We believe this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's interdiction. Hashem is intervening in history. That raises, it has to raise, a lot of very important questions. And it could be that one of the larger critiques of the religious Zionist world is that we don't question ourselves enough. Part of a healthy society and a healthy personal life is to question yourself and to probe, to always check yourself, and not to be too brash and too cocky and too confident that we're right, and this is the derech, and calibration, especially with a derech that tries to calibrate between many different values. Keep in mind, religious Zionism is not the same as modern Orthodox. They may look similar, maybe a lot of people that live in similar societies, but modern Orthodoxy is predominantly concerned with how to take Torah, classic values, classic mitzvahs, and apply it to a new world that has embraced Jews, given them professional opportunity, cultural opportunity. Should we open the doors? Should we close the doors? How many doors? How far should it be open? Religious Zionism is not concerned with that. Religious Zionism is primarily concerned with how do we preserve the old-style, classical, traditional Torah mitzvos, but all of a sudden breathe religious spirit into this new state of Israel that we're living in, that Hashem wants us to advance. So there's a lot of overlap, because modern Orthodox people are also very interested in how to advance Israel. And generally, many religious Zionists, though not all, are a little bit more open to the world in general, though it's not always true. But they're two very, very different pivots. Don't confuse the two worlds, okay? So this is the religious Zionist world and the issues it's struggling with, very different from the modern Orthodox world and the issues that it tends to struggle with. So there are two issues in Zionism, in religious Zionism, that Rav Amital spoke about Parshas Bereishis 19 years ago. This is the scene, 2001. I actually gave a shorter version of this to the boys. Their attention span isn't that great. So I only gave them a few minutes yesterday after davening. And someone who is now a very, very respected member of his community, gives shiurim, a big Talmud Chacham, a professional, said, I was at that sicha 19 years ago, and I remember when Rav Amital gave that sicha. The scene was the Intifada, the second Intifada had broken out. It's a very, very difficult time, and a lot of people were thinking how to respond, what does this say about Is this a redemptive process? Is there so much terror if we're retreating from parts of Eretz Yisrael? And I think during the years between 1995, the Oslo Accords, roughly, and 2005, 2006, if you extend it to the withdrawal or the retreat or the whatever you call it from Gaza, those are years in which Rav Amital really steadied and stabilized religious Zionism. There was a lot of cross currents in what people were thinking and what we should say. The two fault lines we're going to probe today. And when we probe fault lines, we obviously are not going to fall on either side of the fault line. We're just going to probe them and make sure that we're delicate in calibrating between the two are the following. First of all, religious Zionism is revolutionary. It's a new world. We're starting to think of ways of Avodas Hashem that our grandparents didn't imagine. Either in technical, concrete terms, our grandparents weren't involved in keeping Shemitah. Our grandparents weren't involved in Trumos Maestros. Our grandparents weren't involved in a Harabayas. So there are technical issues that we wrestle with that our grandparents were not involved with. This is something we don't have in the boys' school. This is one of the differences. Nice. Okay. Although I'm sure you've heard the famous baby crying story, right? So, Baruch Hashem, here you're Makayimit. You really learned Torah when the baby's crying. You don't take care of the baby. Just keep learning, right? Anyway, those who know the story, it's a really, really good story. I'll send Rav Amital's famous baby crying story. In any event, so, and not just in terms of particular halachos that are new, but in thoughts and in ideas. What does it mean to have a state? What does it mean to have an army? What does it mean to have a police force? What does it mean to have a national voice? What does it mean? So it's not just we're thinking in new terms in a micro level. There are now more mitzvahs that we have to navigate and that we have the opportunity to perform, but the whole mind space is new. On the other hand, there's a danger. And that danger is, well, it feels so new that anything old is irrelevant, an old style. If you want to look at it in a rather polarized, radical form, a lot of the original anti-religious, secular left-wingers, today you don't have so many of them, more the mass of the state of Israel are more what we call Mesorati. They may not keep mitzvahs in the classic sense, but they're sympathetic to religion and traditionalism. A lot of Svardim, as you may meet or know in the country, don't keep mitzvahs, but have a very strong sense of tradition. But the original founders were very staunchly anti-religious, and they were embarrassed of the gullus Jew, the Jew of exile, who was weak and vulnerable and couldn't defend himself. And anything that happened before 1948 was irrelevant, shameful, sad, tragic. 1948 is when the modern Jew was born. It's a very dangerous idea. Very dangerous. Those of you who may one day live in Israel, you'll see a lot of people ask me, why is it so hard to raise kids in Israel? Well, that's a whole shiur unto itself. But it is hard because you're living in quicksand. When you're living in Teaneck or you're living in Queens, you're living on rock solid ground. Basically, what did my parents do? What did their parents do? You make changes, you adapt, but the ground is solid, you make changes. Whereas you're living on quicksand. Everything that I went through is seen by my kids as old style and no longer relevant. And so it's a harder prospect when you make Aliyah, when you live in this country. So how do you calibrate those two? And one of Rav Amital's, I think, and Rav Lichtenstein certainly, is creating a traditionalist strand in the Hesder movement. I'll talk about this a little bit later. That as much as it's new, as much as the yeshiva was new, as much as we studied Tanakh and women's learning and settlement, so many new elements were tossed into this salad, the feel was still very traditionalist. And I'll tell you how Rav Amital made it feel traditional. So that's one fault line. The second fault line, which we're going to study much more directly in the Ramban and Rashi, is how much confidence should you have when you live in Israel? After all, this is redemption. This is Gula. It can't go wrong. What? Okay. Good cue. How much confidence should you have living in Israel? After all, we have our army. We have helicopters. This is redemptive. This is Hashem's promises. This is prophetic. Reality can't stand in the way of prophecy. Or no. Really important question. A lot of the faults of religious Zionism is sometimes to act too overconfident, too self-assured. We know what the end line is. Extreme version of it. Obviously, no one would believe in this, but there are people who say it and suggest it. When I say, no, I mean, no one sitting in this courtyard. Blow up the Temple Mountain. Why? Because then 200 million Arabs will invade, and Hashem will be forced to save us. Because the end point is already written. The terminus is known. So why don't we just accelerate it so that it could be expedited? That's a supreme overconfidence in a redemptive process. We can't go wrong. No matter what you do, you can't go wrong. So how do you balance between those two? That's what we'll study first. And Rav Amital drew it from a very interesting machlokas between the Ramban and Rashi in the beginning of Bereishis, But before we even get to that machlokas, an important point about Rav Amital, and there's no guarantee we'll even get to Rav Lichtenstein, because once I start talking about the Rosh Hashiva, it could take forever. Okay, so, and may the hour may end, but we'll get to it at some point. First Rashi. Bereshis bar Elokim, es ha-shamayim v'es-haaretz. First Rashi in the Torah. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Some people say that Rashi included this. Anyone know? To give cover to his father. His name is Yitzchak. V'shalom Yitzchaki. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Lo ha-yitzarech la-hatchil es ha-tara ela me'achodesh hazel lechem shi mitzvah rishona shenitztava Yisrael. U'matam pasach b'bereshis. Why does the Torah write Sefer Bereshis? It should start from Bo, where the mitzvahs begin. At some point, we'll hear of Lichtenstein buying into this assumption, of course, because Torah is halacha, and human life is being mandated, and our identity is to be of the Hashem. So what do we care about stories when we just need mitzvahs? But the Ramban, and of course Rav Amital, question the premise of this question. So much in life, in learning, is taking a step back and not answering the question, but asking what is this question premised upon? Understanding the assumptions, the predicate, and then you're able to expand your world. So you take a detail and stretch it to more panoramic thought. Well, it's assuming this, do I agree with that assumption? How much do I apply to the assumption? It's taking a step back and thinking, not just lunging into frontal responses. Here's the question, here's the answer. Here's a question. What do you mean? What does Rashi mean? Why does the Torah write Sefer Bereshis? Because it describes how HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. And that's at the foundation of our faith, that the Ribbono Shel Olam created the world in 6 days and created man and punished man when he sinned and expelled man. What is Rashi asking? What do we need Sefer Bereshis? And he comes up with an excuse. Of course we need Sefer Bereshis. It's the pivot of Jewish identity. So the Ramban asks that question. V'yesh L'shol, second paragraph in the Ramban. Ki tzarech gadol hu l'hatchil ha-Torah b'Bereshis bara. Kishar Shemuna, of course. The answer's obvious, no brainer. Sheinu Mamin Bezev, Choshesh Shalom Kadmon, if you don't agree, if you don't believe that Hashem created the world, you think the world came before Hashem and always existed, who cover bigger? You're a heretic. Of course we need Bereshis. So the Ramban's answer, and I'll just say it in Rav Amital's words and in my words, but this is Ramban, Rav Amital, me, but I'm just tossing it together. You really don't get that much from Bereshis. You want to know how the world was created? Here's Parshas Bereshis. Good luck to you. Very, very general details. How long were the 6 days? Even if I assume that after day four, when the planets start to operate and time began to be quantified, that they were actual days, which is anyone's guess. Beforehand, each day could have been, I can't even say the words because there's no way to measure time. There are no planets. So, and wait a second. What's the first pasuk? Bereshis bara Elokim shamayim v'haaretz v'haaretz ha'yis asov v'vo v'ruach Elokim merachefes al pnei ha'moyim. Evidently, we're joining this story in the middle of the movie. Bereshis bara Elokim doesn't mean in the beginning, as Rashi says the next Rashi. As Hashem started to create the world, there was a stage in which there was water and Hashem's spirit hovering upon the water, and Hashem's first move was light and dark. Separate that. Well, how did the water come about? And what was that water? And where was that water? And you know what else? What is space? Who created space? I know what space is, but how did it come to being? Space is also something, a dimension. Who created, how did Hashem create space? Of course Hashem created space. When did he create space? So you don't have much here. And then even after Bereshis, how did Adam sin? Where was Gan Eden? What was the Eitz Hadas? Vidin of Eitz Hara? Who are these men of God who fell in the end of Parshas Bereshis, who married children of men? And when did the Mabul happen? How long did it take? And what happened to the dating scheme when the planets ceased to operate during the Mabul? And very, very sketchy. Which means as follows. That these questions, they're important. We think about them from time to time. But they can form the foundation of your belief. We will never know exactly how the world was created and exactly how many years, and how many worlds does Chazal say preceded this world, because the Gemara talks about prior worlds. And faith can't be reduced to having answers to all of these philosophical questions. Faith has to be predicated on accepting certain truths that we know, that are delivered to us, questioning as best we can, but not just questioning the framework, but filling the framework with content. Philosophy for some is enriching, philosophy for others is pointless, but it's never going to uncork all the answers because it's a human system meant to try to tackle the divine, and philosophy is limited by human convention. Philosophy is human language, but at its root, every word that human beings conjure is irrelevant to Hashem, because there's no word in your mind or imagination that can apply to Hashem who's infinite, unknowable, impenetrable, infallible. So it's all just a crapshoot. Some people find that it's helpful to create some order, some basic framework as to how to go about thinking about our world. Some people think that it's less helpful, it's a waste of time, but it's your choice. But religion and faith can't be predicated upon, well, I'm going to get all the answers, and I'll find out, and get a front row seat to Maisa Bereishis, and I'll open up Sefer Bereishis. That's why Chazal say, and now, of course, I'm adding some of my own ideas. If you take a look at source number 7, we'll come back to some of the others. Rabbi Yonah Meshemi B'Levi Amar, Lama Nivra Olam Bebeis. I remember about 11 or 12 years ago, I was Chasan Tara in Yeshiva. And we had a tish for the Chasanei Torah, and Rav Amital was there, and I quoted this medrash to Rav Amital. So Rav Amital, this is a medrash you would like, right? This is a medrash you taught us about. Why was the world created with beis, bereishis? Why not some other letter, most prominently aleph? I would have started with aleph. That's a logical choice. Why with beis? Source 7, it's a medrash. Beis es sasum mikol tzadav upasach milafanav. A beis is closed on top, closed on bottom, closed behind, and they're only open going forward. Kach ein lecha rishus lomar malamata, malamata, malifnim, malachor, ela miyom shenivra olam vilahaba. You're never going to know what's above you and what's below you and what's behind you. They're closed. They're not available to human logic. I know what's ahead of me. I know that I live today. I breathe today. HaKadosh Baruch Hu made me live today. I've got opportunities today. I don't know what Olam Haba is. I don't know what the previous worlds were. It's a way to ground your religion rather than letting your Avodas Hashem just be tossed around based on questions and answers. And when you're young, you think that you're going to get all the answers, and you start to realize life's about getting answers to some questions and living with many more questions and having the shoulders to bear the questions. So here's the money shot. Here's the line Rav Amital would say every year at the Tish, right after Simchas Torah for the Chasan Torah Chasan Bereishis. And it allowed us, before I tell you the money line, the phrase, it allowed us as Gush boys who thought ourselves to be so sophisticated, such great thinkers, to realize we don't have to know it all. Rav Amital, who had a fourth grade education in a shtetl in Hungary, Rav Amital would tell us, I'm just a simple Jew. I start reading the Torah from Parshas Lech Lecha. I don't know what's going on in Bereishis and Noach. I don't know Big Bang or Small Bang. I just know one thing. Hashem instructed Avram to move to Israel. I move to Israel. I start reading the Torah with Lech Lecha. Okay, now there's a mitzvah to read the Torah beforehand as well, and it's 2,000 years of Jewish, of human history. But to have those expectations, here I am, I'm going to crack it all. And this Rashi, before he even starts talking, is rejecting those expectations. Don't expect Bereishis to be a roadmap to answer all your philosophical questions. You're not going to know anything. You're not going to know that much more. And hence, the question is realistic. So I start even bother writing events that we can't fully describe. I can describe Avram, Rachel, Leah. These are human beings, how they interacted, what they said to one another, what actions they took, what actions they didn't take. I'm at a loss. I'm at a loss in Bereishis and Noach. So I read some general ideas, general morals, general, obviously Hashem created the world. But don't expect it to be scientific, precise. Not only that, but A, if you peer too closely at them, you could be led to heresy. B, it's almost as if this is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's domain that he doesn't want us peering in on. If you look at the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, in Chagiga, I'm sorry, I hope I quoted Mishnah in Chagiga. Did I quote it? I think I'd wanted to, but it didn't make the final cut. Mishnah Chagiga is on the last page. Yeah, sorry, last page.
Look at the Mishnah Chagiga. It's unnumbered. My footnote, my sources were a little discombobulated. Ein darshin barayis b'shlosha v'lobim maseh breishis b'shnayim v'lobim merkava b'yachid. So we know what arayis are. We know what merkava is. But you should even start merkava is Kabbalah, metaphysics, mysticism. But you should even start talking about maseh breishis, how the world was created with more than two people. Because there's so much room for error. You read the pasuk in Parak Aleph, Nasa Adam Bitzalmeinu Kid Museinu. Let's make man. Hashem's talking to other beings. Let's make man. That's a shocker. Hashem created us exclusively. So Rashi fills in. Hashem is showing humility. Hashem is showing civility and politeness, asking the angels. They're going to be rivaled by man. But there's so many landmines. You have to be careful. Let's be one-on-one rather than in a group setting. And from the next medrash I'm about to read, it sounds like the problem is that it's not just margin of error. As I said before, it's not what Hashem wants us to be involved in. This is the end. This is the end of creation, and then we move on to history. Everything else is prehistory, let's call it in our terms. Rabbi Levi was one of the great, great Tanaim of the medrash. He was a Talmud of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. So Rabbi Levi was one of the dominant Tanaim in the Medrash. Rabbi Levi said, he quoted a pasuk in Mishlei, when he got to this pasuk, he said, Kivod Elokim Haster Davar, the Kivod Melachim Chakor Davar. You show honor to Hashem by keeping things concealed, just like you show honor to kings by studying their ideas. Darash Rabbi Levi Shem Rabbi Chama, Mitchilas Asei for Viat Khan, line number 3 of that last page, from the word Bereshis until this pasuk, Kivod Elokim Haster Davar. It's better not to ask too many questions. Mikan va'enlach, once we reach this pasuk, kivod melachim chakor davar, then ask more questions. So for Levi, the border, the boundary was that first parsha, that first parak, vayar lakim kito, it's hard. After the world is created, okay, Adam, Chava, Eitz Hadas, Eitz Chayim, Gan Eden, murder, Kayin, Eva, a little bit easier. That was Levi's boundary. But even without Reb Levi's boundary, there's a sense that, at least in these two partials, and in general, you're not going to get answers. You have to cross that Rubicon and learn that religion is not, as Reb Lichtenstein said, and so much of Reb Aaron and Reb Amital blend into each other, the source of faith is faith itself. No one's going to prove Har Sinai to you. No one's going to prove God to you. No, either you're willing to accept, deliver truths from people whom you trust, or you're going to be lost in a wilderness of self-mediation. Because once you go down that track that you'll only accept truths that your cognition can mediate, you're going to be lost in the woods. And unfortunately, modern world is a lot of that talk. I don't accept anything I can't prove, very scientific, age of science, age of reason. This is why the modern culture is at such crossroads in some ways with religion, because we're trained to be empiricists. And religion is not empirical. You can prove and elucidate what you've already accepted. You can try to prove and elaborate, but you can't really start from a tableau rosa and prove everything. And you just trust. One of my colleagues once put it this way, and then I'll start answering some questions. I know I've given you a lot to think about. But I'll say it in my own terms, but I'm just paraphrasing one of my colleagues. I met a person that I could never imagine becoming or ever meeting again. His name was Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and his level of erudition, and his level of moral willpower, and his level of perfecting his personality, and his level of religiosity, and his level of commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, were beyond terms. I'm a person of words. I can't describe it. I need hours to enumerate it and describe it to you. But you know what's interesting? When Rav Lichtenstein described Rabbi Soloveitchik to me, he described Rabbi Soloveitchik in the same way that I saw Rav Lichtenstein. So I imagine Rabbi Soloveitchik was Rav Lichtenstein squared or cubed. And when Rav Soloveitchik described Rav Chaim to Rav Lichtenstein, he described Rav Chaim in the way that Rav Lichtenstein described the Rav to me, and that I saw Rav Lichtenstein, or that I'm describing it to you. So Rav Chaim meets Rav Lichtenstein to the eighth. And when Rav Chaim told the Rav about Rav Chaim Volozhiner, so you're part of this Masara with great people who are pondering ideas, who connect you to Har Sinai. That doesn't exempt you from personalizing it. There's a difference between personalizing and finding answers. Personalizing means it's a new generation, it's 21st century, new issues. How do I take those ideas and adapt and breathe fresh energy and articulate them differently and make adjustments? we're basically working with the ideas, and this is where I'm headed to. I know the target, you know, shoot a little to the left of the target, a little right to the target, because my positioning changes. As opposed to saying, here I'm going to find all the answers, very few, if any, people succeed in that process. So before we even start Rashi and Ramban, before we even start our shir, there's a really, really important, and Ramban says, those of you take a second, read the Ramban, that's his basic point, that everything's imprecise and bracious, so why bother writing it? Okay, questions. What's your name?
Danielle
what? Tuckman, from where? Okay, so I think the difference between the Rambam and others would be degree, but not infrastructure, not architecture. Namely, architecturally, you can't know it all. How much can you know? The Rambam believed that he could decipher more, and he tried to decipher more. But if you push the envelope, okay, how did that come about? How did this come about? The Rambam would also meet the dead end. So the Rambam was certainly more logical in general, not just with addressing religion, but in terms of that calibration in life and in religion between logic and tradition. The Rambam was a great rationalist. He was one of, but he was in the minority. Most of the medievalists were much more Kabbalistic and mystical than they were, or they were a combination of the two, more so than the Rambam and Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon, who were the great rationalizers of Yiddishkeit. So, but in terms of Maaseh Bereishis, the Rambam does go into greater detail, but even he reaches, obviously, you just keep pushing it, but where did that come from? Where did that come? How did this? Once you ask those next hows, you're going to reach the dead end. Yes, what's your name? Rivka what?
Ben-Nun.
Okay. A lot to unpack in your question. I'll leave Kabbalists on the side. Kabbalah doesn't necessarily talk about Maaseh Bereishis. It talks about other worlds, but not how they came into about. But look, the premise of the Gemara in Chagiga is that there is information that's accurate, the Mishnah in Chagiga, and that information can be conveyed as long as it's conveyed in a more personal setting to leave less room for error. Right? When the Mishnah says you can teach Maaseh Bereishis, but you just, the source we just read, the Mishnah Chagiga, you just can't teach it to more than one person. So you only teach it to one person, not to two. It sounds like there is some information that we can have accurate assessment of, and I can deliver it to you, let's say, but I can't sit with you and Danielle together and teach more than one person. But again, I think the biggest mistake in Chazal, when people read Chazal, they just assume that it's monotonic. Chazal are different voices. So the author of this Mishnah felt that there is some degree of information that can be delivered. Again, based on Donatello, you'd still reach an end, but it's still worthwhile to engage in it on a one-to-one basis. So I think with Blavi, when he said in that matter, Blavi said, no, it's more respectful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu just to accept his world and then move forward than to question how did it come about. So that matter that I wrote about would be Levi Ad Kan Haster Davar. That's a little bit of a different voice in the Mishnah and Chagiga. So Chazal spoke in different voices, and I think they spoke in different voices, not just because they were different people, because they were speaking to different people and they don't want us to be the same person. So someone who's a little bit more philosophically inclined, let's say like the Rambam, or someone in this room, after you've learned a lot of other things as your baseline, it shouldn't be your first thing you learn, say, you know, let me sit down with a really great person like the Rambam, who may know a little bit about Maaseh Bereishis, and I'll fulfill the mission in Chagiga. Someone else will say, like, you can tell my bias already, I'm more of a Rebbelevi person. I don't want to waste my time with that stuff. I'd rather just fill my life with content rather than questioning the framework. So I think Chazal is speaking in different voices, but those voices are not polar, like yes or no. Those voices are within a certain range. Is there more wiggle room, as I discussed with Danielle? What's her? Danielle.
Yeah.
Danielle. Okay. Rivka, Danielle. Yes, what's your name? Efrat, yes. No, I say, look, Rashi, I'm making Rashi very dramatic. I'm just saying, don't enter the field. Both questions can be answered with one response, in my opinion. Don't enter this assuming you're going to reach. When you study math, you assume you're going to reach, oh, I'm close to the answer. There's no close to the answer to math. Either you have the answer or you don't have the answer. Either at the end of the equation, you're not at the end of physics, chemistry. It's not going to be precise. So you study. I'm sure that if I had the time to go through your syllabus from whatever school you studied, say for abrasions, I could poke holes with almost every statement that was made. Not just me and everyone. Because I could just ask questions that would push whatever statements to the brink and say, well, how do you know it? How can you prove it? What does it mean? And almost every conversation in Bracious can be repudiated by just pushing questions. It's still valuable to establish some baseline. I think it's valuable to study Bracious and think about how the Yetzirah comes into about and different levels of the Yetzirah and human loyalty. And I'm not saying that we should wipe out Bracious. If Ramita was speaking in exaggerated forms, saying, don't enter Bracious. Mishpatim, I can dissect Mishpatim through Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra, and each word leads to thousands of halachos that are precisely delivered. Bereishis is more general, Kain and Hevel. The three different stories as to what they fought about. So it's important to see people sinning. It's important to see the first person to perform tshuva, even though that tshuva is very lame, this tshuva of Kain. There are some important things, but don't read it with the expectation, and don't pivot. Oh my goodness, if I don't understand Bereishis and I have questions in Bereishis, the entire religion is flawed because Bereishis is the foundation. It's not the foundation. It provides foundational messages, but after those foundational messages, it gets very sketchy. Yes, what's your name?
I'm Melodic.
Melodic?
Melodic.
Okay.
And I feel like in that class, we did a lot of Mefarshi, and we also did a lot of modern thinkers, and probably some that we wouldn't be here. But I feel like if you are asking, there's so many questions that you can ask, and if you're so preoccupied on how, the questions how was the world created in 6 days is not something that is a truth that's going to give you meaning or midot, versus how man and woman's relationship, or how do we have free will. And I feel if you're so preoccupied on the how, then you're gonna miss the real mashal of Bereishis, and I think that happens.
Okay. I mean, if I understand you correctly, you're introducing a different concern. Not just the imprecision of it, but the distraction. That a person, let's take it out of Bereishis. We know many philosophers who aren't moral. Why? Because in some way, questioning larger issues either distracts you from questioning more grounded moral issues. Should I be a kind person? Should I be a nice person? Should I be... the great irony, let's say, for example, people who are protesters for social justice. Okay, so you go out and you hold up flags and you speak on behalf of large ideas. Do you come home and treat your wife properly? Are you a kind neighbor? Are you a polite person? And I haven't interviewed the protesters, but sometimes these high-minded agendas can distract us from day-to-day moral, ethical forms of behavior. And either they distract because we're just too preoccupied, or they distract because we get meaning, because we feel that ideas give us meaning. In the end of the day, meaning has to come from implementation. Are you a kind person? Are you a good person? You feel can't be, because I have the answers, because I'm smart, because I'm intellectually gifted, because I'm able to articulate. So I think it's a healthy point. I wasn't discussing that point. I think it's a healthy point. It's a legitimate point. Okay?
I never looked at
Bereishis. Right. I mean, look, we have to get to, we have 5 minutes left. A little bit more. What's your question? Noam?
Yeah.
Noam what?
Goldberg-Kelman.
Yeah, I think it goes back to, what's your name? Yoni's point before, that there's always a danger that the more abstract and the more technical and logistical something becomes, it's called the patient on the operating table effect. If you sit and you learn Tanakh and you feel you don't know where you're heading and you just accept truths from people, so there's a mystique and there's a grandeur and this is the word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But once you become empowered with technique and with skill and you could dissect a sugya, then it has less mystique and it has less of that feel that it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence. And there's always that balance between the two. I think we had a conversation about 15, 20 years ago in the yeshiva. Should we give the boys an introduction to Torah Sheval Peh? Should we have a course in the introduction to Torah Sheval Peh? It's a course that's offered in the Herzog teachers, because teachers have to know where it comes, who the Tanaim were, who the Amoraim were, how they operated, where they lived, where the difference was. And part of that conversation was, you're taking away the mystique. When you sit in front of a Gemara, there should be a mystique. These are great people. They lived in a great era. They knew Torah so massively beyond ourselves. It's almost like they're superhumans. We don't want to place them. We don't want to know where they live, where they live. It's just this group of people, like the people. You know, our chazal, they're beyond. Okay, so there's a calibration between the two. So I think that's part of what you're saying, is that once we start to develop the skills and reading Rishonim, it can drift us far from moral delivery, or at least from this devotional reading. You know, my reading, because every word is Devar Hashem, and every word was given in our Sinai, and listen from Torah. Let's spend a few minutes just seeing what I plan to talk about today, okay? The answer of Rashi versus the answer of the Ramban. How Rav Amital dealt with this dichotomy, how it influenced religious, all that stuff that we're supposed to speak about before we got into all this distraction. Okay, so what does Rashi say? Rashi says the reason that the Torah begins with Bereishis is to instruct us and empower us to our rights to this country. One of the most prophetic Rashis, it can't get more prophetic than this Rashi. One day, there may be people in the world who'll dispute our rights to this land. You think? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu clears the deck before it all begins. Bereishis Bara Elokim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world. There is no sense of ownership. You don't own anything. And if you study halacha, you'll see that in halacha, even real ownership, not just collective national ownership, country, who owns which piece of land, but if the skirt you're wearing, do you really own it? Or do you own its utility? Because you can't own anything. You're here for 80 years. Hashem created material. You own something. Very socialist. And so when it comes to land, so if you, I'm talking about long haul studying of kinyanim or metaltlin and karka and how we define bailus. And it's like spending 7 years studying Bava Basra. It comes out, it's because Lashem haaretz umloa. Everything is that. What do you mean I own it? So, walk into the UN, and you own it, I own it. I mean, even in human terms, I laugh every time people say that settlements are illegal. What does that mean? Which system of law, under which guidelines? What? Even there, don't just buy into these little these platitudes. Exactly which system of law means I can't purchase land and build my house on a piece of land? Because, oh, the UN described. Now we have to think about UN law. Is it binding? And is it political? It's just like these simple, like, always take a step back and question the premise. Those, yeah, well, it's illegal, but I don't care. Is it really illegal? But the first Rashi is saying, what does it mean? Legalities of man to determine ownership? Kadosh Baruch Hu decides. Am Yisrael receives the land. And Rashi quotes a very famous pasuk. Let's look back at Rashi. Famous pasuk in Rashi. It's from Tehillim Kuf Yud Aleph. I think it was yesterday's Tehillim. Koach Maisav, source number 2, line 3. Higid Liyama, Hashem taught us his creation. Koach Maisav, literally. Lasei Slehem Nachlas Goyim, to deliver the land of other nations. It's our land. No ifs, ands, or buts. Ramban has a different pasuk and a slightly nuanced takeaway. You hear Rashi, we belong in this land. No ifs, ands, or buts. That's why the Torah begins with Bereishis. Because Hashem created the land, he delivers it to whom he decides. V'nasan Reb Yitzchak, third paragraph of the Ramban, source 3. Listen to the tonality of the Ramban, a little different. Ki tchila Torah b'Bereishis bara Elokim, he's quoting the same Reb Yitzchak, but interpreting it differently. V'sipur kol inyan ha-yitzira b'riyas ha-adam, and the creation of man, and man was positioned to be the pinnacle of creation, and we're in Gan Eden, so what's the punchline? We're in Gan Eden, it's ours, man controls, here it's man, not Jew, Adam. Line number Until we no longer deserve Gan Eden because of our sin. And this is a repeating pattern. People lose their rights to live where they want to when they sin. Adam and Chava abdicate their rights to Gan Eden when they sin. Cain abdicates his right to live a stable life when he sins. The Dara Mabel abrogate their right to live on this planet when they sin. Very different tone. You have to deserve it. Not just a given. Your religious behavior has to warrant the land that you're destined to live on. Im Kain Ra'uihu, last paragraph, Kasha Yosef Agoy Lachto, whenever a nation, any nation sins, Shi Yovad Mimkomo, they'll be banished from their place. V'yavagoy Achel Reshes Tzertzo, Ki Cheinu Mishpat Elokim. Bereshis is not just teaching us Hashem created the world, Hashem will deliver to whoever he chooses, it's teaching us a drama of human history, that people who sin lose their right to their land, divinely. V'enaroy Shi Yerush Mivchar Mekom Asi Yishuv. Avol Yerushua, line number 4, Avdei Hashem Zera'ovo, people that are Avdei Hashem. Listen to the pasuk the Ramban quotes. Remember the pasuk Rashi quoted: "Koach Ma'isav Higid Le'amo L'Seisam Nach L'Skoyim." Hashem is going to deliver land to the Jews. Listen to the more morally contingent pasuk the Ramban quotes from Tehillim Kofei, three lines from the bottom, fourth paragraph: "Va'itin Lem Artzos Goyim." Hashem deliver the land of nations to His servants. Va'malu Mim Yerushua, and the work and toil. It's on first page. It says first page Ramban source 3, paragraph 4. Line 3 from the bottom, paragraph 4. V'amal lu'umim yirashu, and the work and toil of other nations the Jews will inherit, b'avor yishmru chukav v'tarasav yinsaru, so that will keep his Torah. So are you hearing two different voices here? One voice is the voice of Rashi. We're here. This is our land. This is our destiny. It's ours. One voice is the voice of the Ramban. Yeah, but nothing is a given. You have to earn it, it's not indissoluble. You can lose it. You can forfeit your rights if you don't behave properly. So, these are the two voices that Rav Amital made sure remained within religious Zionism whenever he felt that that voice was being eviscerated or eroding. And let me give you some examples. And what he spoke about in 2001. 2001 was a very difficult period. There was literally blood in the streets. We lived through it. In fact, that person who's now an adult said he remembers thinking about all of you and the boys being here on these mountains for 8-9 weeks. Says there were boys then who came to Gush. I wasn't as in touch with the girls in Migdal Oz, but... And the condition for their coming to Gush for the year was they couldn't leave Alon Shvut the entire year. In fact, looking at some of your sweatshirts and thinking about some of the schools you go to and many of the teachers you may have met, some of them were your teachers who came to live in Gush for 10, 11 months straight. And this man who wrote this WhatsApp, he said, and it made them feel like such a part of this process, like, when you struggle and you have to sacrifice for something, your buy-in is just, like my buy-in is because I was in the yeshiva during the Lebanon War. So we had a clear sense that when all of our friends were fighting and some of them dying in Lebanon, we had to keep the yeshiva going. So we didn't stop learning. Like it wasn't just, I'm here, it's my gap year, go next year to college, I'm here with my friends, let's go get some pizza. It's like, this is real. And hopefully for some of you, I mean, I'm excited with all the restrictions logistically. This is a more real and raw experience for you because you have to sacrifice for it. You're not just here with your friends and going out. This is real. This is when life gets real, your buy-in and your tie-in is much, much firmer. So it was a hard time and people were saying, how do we know this is redemptive and how do we know? Maybe it isn't. So Rav Amital told the story of Rav Herzog, who was the first chief rabbi of the State of Israel. And someone once asked him that question. How do you know? And Rav Herzog said the following: we have a masara that there won't be a third Churban. Now, Rav Amital once told us why that masara came about, because in the Torah there are two tochachos, there are two descriptions of the Jews being exiled. One is in Bichlukosai, one is in Kitavo. And the Ramban says that the Tochacha and Bechukosai corresponds to Galus Bavel, and the Tochacha and Kitavo corresponds to the long Galus of Christianity and Western civilization. And he has 10, 11, 12 proofs. There's no third Tochacha. It doesn't exist. Which means that we're back, and the prospect that 7-8 million Jews, however many million Jews live in Israel, are going to be expelled, that would be a gullus. It's not just 1,000 Jews coming back and being, that would be a gullus. And we have a masorah that there isn't a gullus. So as hard as life gets in Israel, Rav Amital, the phrase he would always say, lo litragesh, lo litragesh, don't panic. Keep your eye to the larger perspective. And he talked in 2001 about the Intifada, and he was not in any way trivializing the loss of life, and no one lived loss of life in Talmidim more deeply than Rav Amital. If you have a chance, you can look up on YouTube Rav Lichtenstein's Hesped for Rav Amital. 10 years ago he died. And in Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's Hesped for Rav Amital, he said one of the things Rav Amital really established was the notion of a Rosh Yeshiva living through the death of his Talmidim. Remember, this is the first time in 2,000 years since Rabbi Akiva that a Rosh Yeshiva loses Talmidim in battle. It never happened before. Obviously, people lost Talmidim and lost, but it's a different feel when basically you're the one sending them to battle. You're not their general, but you're their spiritual guide. And okay, this is something I recommend for you, and I'm going to steer you towards. And I saw this throughout my life with Rav Amital, how he lived it on his flesh. Basically, in 1973, after 8 boys died in the Yom Kippur War, Rav Amital gave the keys to the yeshiva to Rav Lichtenstein. I can't do this. He was just too traumatized because he lived. He went to each Levi, he went to every hospital bed. And the Intifada for Rav Amital was not a strategic threat. And this is not something that's going to strategically threaten our country and see it that way. All these doomsday prophecies and where are we heading? And in some ways, let your mind wander, chas v'shalom, chas v'shalom, Corona is more of a strategic threat than the Intifada. Because you can paint a scenario where one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, and then the country is really teetering. The Intifada is not going to bring down a country. It's psychological, and the response is psychological, and you have to, different ways to do it. You say, maybe we should be more involved in the peace discussion. Those are all legitimate, but any way you shake it, any way you slice it, isn't a strategic threat. Rav Amital quoted during that sikha, he quoted, where is it here? A Gemara in Shabbos. Is it Gemara in Shabbos? Yeah, it's on the bottom of page 1, source 4. Amos Yitush al Apil, I'll just abbreviate, second line. A fly frightens an elephant. Why does a fly frighten an elephant? Because a fly can be annoying, can be irritating, get an elephant's nose. The elephant doesn't really have fingers to scratch that little nose. Nose is really important for the elephant. Air, food, needs its nose. Okay, but the fly's not going to murder the elephant. The elephant's going to live. It's just you have to differentiate between life-threatening situations and irritability, annoyance, things that disturb you. So on the one hand, Rav Amital had a real sense of confidence that was born from historical perspective, and he told us what life was really like when the Jewish people were facing extinction, when he went and lived through the horrors of concentration camps, and it was always that perspective, a tremendous, tremendous perspective. Here's a person that started out his life in Hungarian shtetl, lived through the horrors of the Holocaust, fought in the Independence War, marched to the Suez in the Yom Kippur War, and founded the largest Hasidic yeshiva in Israel. So he saw the 20th century. Like, I chuckled to myself imagining him and Menachem Begin having conversations in Shemayim. These are the two people who lived the 20th century state of the Jews and how the Jews evolved. So nothing was going to rattle him. You know, oh my goodness, we have to change the yeshiva. Oh, this problem or that. Very, very unshakable, very unflappable, and very much in his redemptive belief that Hashem has restored us and we have to live with that, and whatever challenges arise. And people had some real questions. In 1995, people stopped saying Reishis Michas Gulaseinu. How could this be Reishis Michas Gulaseinu if we're ceding territory? And certainly in 2006 and during the 2005 disengagement from Gaza, and again, you could debate the terminology Reishis Michas Gulaseinu, but we look at it from a broader perspective, and the broader climb and rise and resettlement of the Jewish people and restoration of Jewish identity, there are going to be setbacks. Doesn't mean the process is ground to a halt. On the other hand, Rav Amital sensed that in the religious Zionist community, sometimes this confidence bred cockiness and apathy almost, and lack of self-inspection. There wasn't enough of, and he looked back to Bar Kochba. Rav Amital deeply, deeply identified with Rabbi Akiva. He felt that his starting the yeshiva was the first since Rabbi Akiva. He said this explicitly. And Rabbi Akiva, of course, supported Bar Kochba. And the Yishalmi has a horrifying, horrifying statement of Bar Kochba. But then I'll tell you a story that Rav Amital told us, and you can see why those trends repeat. If you look at page number two, the top of page number two, V'chkad da'hava nafik, source five, it's Yishalmi and Tainus. We don't have too many reports about Bar Kochba in Chazal. Josephus speaks a lot about it, but we don't have too much in Chazal. This is an interesting statement in the Yishalmi and Tainus. Kad dahave nafak lekrava, when Bar Kochba, kad means when, dahave, nafka, he went out, lekrava, to battle. Amar, he said, Rebona da'alma, Rebona shalolam, lo tisod velo tichsof. Don't support me, don't get in my way. I got this. I'm good, I'm cool. I got my helicopters. I don't need your help, just don't get in my way. Take a pass on this one. I got it. I'll take care of it. Wow. Could you imagine thinking that? But listen to the following story. I think it happened in 2001, but it sounds like a 1980s story, but it could happen in 1980s as well. In 2001, there was a gathering of Rabbanim, and Rav Amital attended that gathering. And he asked one of the Rabbanim, that being that Chevron is going through such difficulties, and in 2001, Chevron went through a lot. Probably the worst incident, and I want you to realize that these are incidents probably you obviously didn't live through, but even if you did, when you live in Chutz La'aretz, you hear about them, you read them in the newspaper, you move on. Here you remember the names, you know the families. We name terror incidents, especially the major ones, by people. Oh, that was the so-and-so, that was the so-and-so. What does you really get to see their levayas on television, on Yom HaZikaron, see these little movies memorializing? So in 2001, or I think 2001, there was a group of people walking down to Ma'aras HaMachpelah, to Davin, Friday night. And the corridor leading from Kiryat Arba to Ma'aras HaMachpelah was lined with Arab houses on either side. And some terrorists stood there and ambushed them, and they literally shot people from high perches on their way to davening. I think, I forget how many people, it was several, maybe even more than 10. And one of the people who was killed with that was a really legendary person in this area, who was a military general colonel. I don't know what his exact rank was, but he was a firm Jew, but like really responsible for security in the overall Gush area. Really mythical figure named Dror Weinberg. If you want to take a look tonight in Hebrew, Wiki Dror Weinberg, and you'll see, and you'll read, and you'll hear about that. So Chevron put up with a lot. There's a lot in Chevron. So I went to ask some of the Rabbanim, so like, shouldn't we be Gozer Etainus? Tshuva, Tzom, a special day of Tefillah. Listen to his answer. It sounds so much like Bar Kochba. Now, Tainus and Tefillah, that's for when we lived in Gullus, when we didn't have army and Jewish politicians. If we want to solve our problems now, we should solve them with the army. And there were two layers to that question. First of all, the phrase during the Intifada, and you can look this up also, was Tenu L'Tzahal L'Natzeach. Basically, people felt that if we just let Tzahal go in there and bulldoze all of Chevron, and they're right, if we just carpet bombed all of Chevron, we'd solve our problems, and we'd also kill hundreds of thousands of innocent people. People are innocent even though they're your enemy. A terrorist is guilty. They're committing an act or they're involved in an act. Your political opponent who doesn't like you and protests against you is an innocent person until they're actively involved in supporting an act of terror. Most Arabs are innocent. They're now no great lovers of Jews, no great lovers of settlers, but they're innocent people. It'd be very easy just to pull a George Bush and carpet bomb like he did in Iraq. And I tell me to tell me what it was like going through Shechem, going room by room, rather than just dropping a few bombs on a street. And many people died because of that. Many soldiers had their lives taken because we don't carpet bomb. But the first part of that statement was harrowing. and on two fronts. What? Tainus and Tefillah, that's part of Golus, that's part of pre-1948, and therefore it's automatically disqualified in post-1948? Don't we see this as a culmination rather than a revolution? Someone once asked me, when did Reishit Tzmichat Geulah Seinu start? You know when Reishit Tzmichat Geulah Seinu started? The moment the last Jew left Jerusalem in 70 AD and performed the first mitzvah. Because our Geulah is a culmination of 2,000 years of mitzvos and tefillos and meisim tovim and chesed and women going to the mikvah and people keeping kashrus and people putting on tefillin. It all counts. Hey, we believe that in 1948 it took a quantum leap forward in ways that became overt and concrete, not just behind the scenes. So winning the independence war is a lot more overt than going to the mikvah in Poland 300 years ago, or putting on tefillin in Spain 700 years ago. But it's all a contribution. It's all a culmination. And that's something very, very dangerous in the religious Zionist world. You may come across it if at any point you visit some people in this country. You'll see, oh, that's old style. That's gullus. Have you ever heard the phrase Torah Eretz Yisraelit? Whole new way to study Torah. Eretz Yisraelit study of Torah. So how do you find that calibration isn't easy. How do you calibrate between those two? One thing I know that Rav Aaron and Rav Amital, and Rav Amital in his way, really gave us the feeling they were continuing what went on back in the old world. The boys asked me over Simchas Torah to tell them what Hakafas were like with Rav Aaron and Rav Amital. So Rav Amital brought us back to the shtetl. There was a little tish with Rav Amital, Simchas Torah night that you had to be invited to, invitation only. And he would teach us all these little songs from the shtetl. And I have to warn you, I'll sing them for you, but the music was terrible and they all sounded the same. These were shtetl songs. You know how they all sounded? Bum bum bim 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 bum 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 bim bum 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 bums. But that's how they sung in the shtetl when they were surrounding the well of water. They weren't singing these flashy, schwecky tunes and flashy. There was a different. In Israel, you still have more of that. The difference between Israeli music, I don't mean Israeli rock music, it was in Israeli wedding music, is all the songs that Israeli sings, the tunes are all repetitive. It sounds like a runaway train. But the words are very, very meaningful. It sounds like, make believe you want a train. And all the songs in Chutzaris is just to sell albums. So the music is flashy and it's the latest. But the words, if they exist, the words are just all the words. You know, the words are very, very soulful. The music, not so great. You know, I wouldn't recommend using Israeli tunes as like your background music for your video project. It's not going to fly. No real good tunes there. But the words are really, really deep. And you really felt like you were in the shtetl. And he was. And he was part of that world. And in general, it's really, really important. In general, and I'm going a little bit off track here, but it's important for me to go off track for you. We'll find the time to speak about the yeshiva world and the Haredi world and our world, and is there Haredi phobia in the modern Orthodox world, and how to counter it, and all that stuff is important. But there's been an appropriation. People talk about cultural appropriation, and I don't know who's guilty, but I know it exists, in which if you put a Haredi, just randomly picked up a Haredi person, put them on one side of the table, and randomly picked up a non-Haredi from person, put them on the other side of the table. You say, well, Haredi said, well, we're a continuation of the yeshiva world pre-Europe, and we're not. And everyone's just buying into that. I don't buy into that. We're a continuation of the yeshiva world pre-Europe just as much as they are. In the middle of the 20th century, there were a few major issues that emerged that had to be dealt with, and these two communities dealt with them very differently. State of Israel, Holocaust, secular Zionism, role of women. So these things didn't exist in 1880. In 1880, Zionism was still very embryonic, no Holocaust, really no state, women weren't being taught Torah in major form. So you go back to 1880, you're in Volozhin, these differences don't end. Now all of a sudden, it's now 1980 and 2020, a lot of issues, but our community has taken certain changes, and their community has taken other responses, and they're different, important, but they're no more a continuation of that world than we are. Now, what makes them think, or you think, is because part of their ideology is preservationist. And part of our ideology is innovationist. And part of that is clothing, and part of that is so. If you dress the same way they dressed then aren't you a more accurate preservation of what they were? And I think they would say yes, because you could make that point. I'm not denouncing their presentation. I'm not teaching them, I'm teaching you. I'm trying to make you feel as much a part of that world as they feel a part of that world. I'm not saying there's no ideology Olympics. Who is more, not here to win the gold medal, who's more? I'm just interested that you not see, oh, my Rebbe and my Rebbe Soloveitchik, Rev Lichtenstein, and my local. Now, you're part of the Vilna Gaon's tradition. You're part of the Chafetz Chaim's tradition. You're part of Rav Aaron Cutler. You're part of that tradition. And of course, you're part of even Rav Aaron Cutler and people who found the lake. But obviously, you're not as much part of that as you are, let's say, Rav Lichtenstein and the Rav. But anyone who comes before, certainly 1920, just pick a round figure, before these issues really burst on the scene, they're not dealing with it, which also, by the way, is part of the answer. Well, they were opposed to the state of Israel. You're opposed to the state of Israel in 1910 with his own paper. It's a different reality now. There's 8 million Jews living in Israel. It's become the epicenter of Judaism. You can't just, by the way, intellectual honesty being as it is, you have to be intellectually honest on both sides. That's why I also disregard a lot of what Rav Kook said. Because Rav Kook's vision of Israel was that all we do is open the state of Israel, bada bing, bada boom, everyone's from. Because it's just going to take 10 years. Even if they're secular, yeah, no, they'll get there. It didn't happen. And also, because Rav Kook didn't envision the Holocaust. So for Rav Kook, it was all peaches and roses. We get back to Israel, cherubs are singing in the sky, angels are welcoming us. What happens when 6 million Jews die? So a lot happened between 1920 and 2020. And if you're honest, it was a really different world. So my point to you is, this isn't a lesson in anthropology, although I may have given you a lesson in anthropology, but you have to be really, really careful before you say, oh, I'm not part of that. No, you're part of that world, and there's some important changes, and we can discuss the changes. Are they right? Are they wrong? And generally, it's my belief that our community is much more forward-thinking, and we take certain changes, and it takes a while for other communities that are more preservationist to catch up. So I think that by 2140, I think there'll be a lot more Torah learning for women across the world. I mean, I just look at college. You know, you look back in the Svarim, the great debates. In 1940, should yeshiva bachurim go to college? They've been rendered irrelevant. Yeshiva people go to college today. They go to night college, summer college, day college, afternoon college, get online. Everyone gets a degree today because it's obvious. You can't earn, if you want to earn a living, you need a degree. So you sit in a Lakewood for 3 years and you get a bachelor in letters and you become a lawyer. Okay, so what difference does that make if you want to? It just means that, and preservationist is good. I was once on a plane 20 years ago with a chassid. I love this, sitting on planes. Remember, we used to travel on planes, and like meeting people I wouldn't normally meet. And I was explaining the internet to him because I'm an early adopter. So I realized, I'm a computer scientist. I always want to be on the cutting edge of technology. And he asked me to explain the internet to him. And I was explaining the hardware and the manner of connection. And I said, do you realize that in 10 years, you will not be able to pay your bank account, your electric bill, or receive any relevant information without having a computer connected to the internet? He said something really wise to me. He said, yeah, that may be true, but at least we'll gain 20 years. There is a position that says, let's be late adopters, let other people be the guinea pigs and make their mistakes, and then we'll see how to adapt properly and how to. So free your mind from the prison of your stigmas. Free your mind from, this is the only approach, and it's my approach, and I'm going to take my approaches off, and I'm, if anyone that didn't go to Frisch, Maimonides, or SAR, a different drachim, you choose your derech, make sure you realize its strengths and its weaknesses, make sure you compensate for them, just as you reinforce your strengths, you compensate for your weaknesses. Many, many, many rooms in Olam Haba, and they're not all reserved for girls from Migdalos. Many other girls in Olam Haba can't choose your roommate. You make it up there, and who knows who you'll get as a roommate in Olam Haba. So this is your derech, and I want to teach you that derech, and hopefully this is a derech for you. But, pump the brakes and all this ideology Olympics, and this is the only derech that doesn't wash in Shemayim. Okay, so we'll stop here. We'll get to our Lichtenstein next week. Okay, deal? We'll flip back to Bereshis next week. You're welcome. It's nice to meet everyone.